Donovan felt as haggard as he looked.
Only 5 days?
Only 5 days. I'm sure of it. Donovan looked about him wretchedly. The stars through the glass were familiar but infinitely indifferent. The walls were cold to the touch. The lights, which had recently flared up again, were unfeelingly bright. The needle on the gauge pointed stubbornly to zero, and Donovan could not get rid of the taste of beans. He said morosely, "I need a bath." Powell looked up briefly and said, "So do I. You needn't feel self-conscious. But unless you want to bathe in milk and do without drinking, we'll do without drinking eventually anyway. Greg, where does this interstellar travel come in?"
"You tell me.
Maybe we just keep on going. We'd get there eventually. At least the dust of our skeletons would. But isn't our death the whole point of the brain's original breakdown?" Donovan spoke with his back to the other.
"Greg, I've been thinking. It's pretty bad. There's not much to do, except walk around or talk to yourself. You know those stories about guys marooned in space? They go nuts long before they starve."
"I don't know, Greg, but ever since the lights went on, I feel funny." There was a silence, then Powell's voice came thin and small.
"So do I. What's it like?"
The red-headed figure turned.
"Feel funny inside. There's a pounding in me with everything tense. It's hard to breathe. I can't stand still."
"Do you feel vibration?"
"How do you mean?"
"Sit down for a minute and listen.
You don't hear it, but you feel it.
As if something's throbbing somewheres, and it's throbbing the whole ship, and you, too, along with it. Listen."
"Yeah. Yeah. What do you think it is, Greg? You don't suppose it's us?"
"It might be." Powell stroked his mustache slowly. "But it might be the ship's engines. It might be getting ready."
"For what?"
"For the interstellar jump. It may be coming, and the devil knows what it's like." Donovan pondered. Then he said, savagely, "If it does, let it. But I wish we could fight. It's humiliating to have to wait for it." An hour later, perhaps, Powell looked at his hand on the metal chair arm and said with frozen calm, "Feel the wall, Mike." Donovan did, and said,
"You can feel it shake, Greg."
Even the stars seemed blurred. From somewhere came the vague impression of a huge machine gathering power with the walls, storing up energy for a mighty leap, throbbing its way up the scales of strength. It came with a suddenness and a stab of pain. Powell stiffened and half jerked from his chair. His sight caught Donovan and blanked out while Donovan's thin shout whimpered and died in his ears. Something writhed within him and struggled against a growing blanket of ice that thickened. Something broke loose and whirled in a blaze of flickering light and pain. It fell, and whirled, and fell headlong into silence. It was death. It was a world of no motion and no sensation. A world of dim, unsensing consciousness, a consciousness of darkness and of silence and of formless struggle. Most of all, a consciousness of eternity. He was a tiny white thread of ego, cold and afraid. Then the words came, unctuous and sonorous, thundering over him in a foam of sound. "Does your coffin fit differently lately? Why not try Morbid M. Cadaver's extensible caskets? They are scientifically designed to fit the natural curves of the body and are enriched with vitamin B1. Use Cadaver's caskets for comfort. Remember, you're going to be dead a long, long time." It wasn't quite sound, but whatever it was, it died away in an oily, rumbling whisper. The white thread that might have been Powell heaved uselessly at the insubstantial eons of time that existed all about him, and collapsed upon itself as the piercing shriek of 100 million ghosts of 100 million soprano voices rose to a crescendo of melody. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. I'll be glad... It rose up a spiral stairway of violent sound into the keening supersonics that passed, hearing, and then beyond. The white thread quivered with a pulsating pang. It strained quietly. The voices were ordinary, and many. It was a crowd speaking, a swirling mob that swept through and past and over him with a rapid, headlong motion that left drifting tatters of words behind them. What did they get you for, boy? You look banged up. A hot fire, I guess, but I got a case. I've made paradise, but old St. Pete. Nah, I got a pull with a boy. Had dealings with him. Hey, Sam, come this way. Did you get a mouthpiece? Beelzebub says... Going on, my good imp. My appointment is with Sate. And above it all, the original stentorian roar that plunged across all. Hurry, hurry, hurry! Stir your bones and don't keep us waiting. There are many more in line. Have your certificates ready and make sure Peter's release is stamped across it. See if you are at the proper entrance gate. There will be plenty of fire for all. Hey, you. You down there. Take your place in line, or... The white thread that was Powell groveled backward before the advancing shout and felt the sharp stab of the pointing finger. It all exploded into a rainbow of sound that dripped its fragments onto an aching brain. Powell was in the chair again. He felt himself shaking. Donovan's eyes were opening into two large, popping bowls of glazed blue. Greg, he whispered in what was almost a sob. Were you dead? I felt dead. He did not recognize his own croak. Donovan was obviously making a bad failure of his attempt to stand up. Are we alive now? Or is there more? I feel... Alive? It was the same hoarseness. Powell said cautiously, Did you hear anything when you were dead? Donovan paused and then very slowly nodded his head. Did you? Yes. Did you hear about coffins and females singing and the lines forming to get into hell? Did you? Donovan shook his head. Just one voice. Loud? No. Soft, but rough, like a file over the fingertips. It was a sermon, you know, about hellfire. He described the tortures of... Well, you know. I once heard a sermon like that. Almost. He was perspiring. They were conscious of sunlight through the port. It was weak, but it was blue-white, and the gleaming pea that was the distant source of light was not Old Sol. And Powell pointed a trembling finger at the single gauge. The needle stood stiff and proud at the hairline whose figure read 300,000 parsecs. Powell said, Mike, if it's true... We must be out of the galaxy altogether. Donovan said, Blazes! Greg, we'd be the first men out of the solar system. Yes, that's just it. We've escaped the sun. We've escaped the galaxy. Mike, this ship is the answer. It means freedom for all humanity, freedom to spread through to every star that exists. Millions and billions and trillions of them. And then he came down with a hard thud. But how do we get back, Mike? Donovan smiled shakily. Oh, that's all right. The ship brought us here. The ship will take us back. Me for more beans. But, Mike,
Hold on, Mike. If it takes us back the way it brought us here... Donovan stopped halfway up and sat back heavily into the chair. Powell went on, "We'll have to die again, Mike." "Well," sighed Donovan, "if we have to, we have to. At least it isn't permanent. Not very permanent."
Susan Calvin was speaking slowly now. For 6 hours, she had been slowly prodding the brain. For 6 fruitless hours. She was weary of repetitions, weary of circumlocutions, weary of everything. "Now, brain, there's just one more thing. You must make a special effort to answer simply. Have you been entirely clear about the interstellar jump? I mean, does it take them very far?"
"As far as they want to go, Miss Susan. Golly, it isn't any trick through the warp."
"And on the other side, what will they see?"
"Stars and stuff. What do you suppose?"
The next question slipped out. "They'll be alive then?"
"Sure."
"And the interstellar jump won't hurt them?"
She froze as the brain maintained silence. That was it. She had touched the sore spot.
"Brain," she supplicated faintly. "Brain, do you hear me?"
The answer was weak, quivering. The brain said, "Do I have to answer? About the jump, I mean?"
"Not if you don't want to. But it would be interesting. I mean, if you wanted to."
Susan Calvin tried to be bright about it.
"Aw, you spoil everything."
And the psychologist jumped up suddenly with a look of flaming insight on her face.
"Oh, my," she gasped. "Oh, my."
And she felt the tension of hours and days released in a burst. It was later that she told Lanning, "I tell you, it's all right. No, you must leave me alone now. The ship will be back safely, with the men, and I want to rest. I will rest. Now go away."
The ship returned to Earth as silently, as unjarringly as it had left. It dropped precisely into place and the main lock gaped open. The two men who walked out felt their way carefully and scratched their rough and scrubbly stubbled chins. And then, slowly and purposefully, the one with red hair knelt down and planted upon the concrete of the runway a firm, loud kiss. They waved aside the crowd that was gathering and made gestures of denial at the eager couple that had piled out of the down-swooping ambulance with a stretcher between them. Gregory Powell said, "Where's the nearest shower?" They were led away. They were gathered, all of them, about a table. It was a full staff meeting of the brains of U.S. Robot and Mechanical Men Corporation. Slowly and climactically, Powell and Donovan finished a graphic and resounding story. Susan Calvin broke the silence that followed. In the few days that had elapsed, she had recovered her icy, somewhat acid calm, but still a trace of embarrassment broke through. "Strictly speaking," she said, "this was my fault. All of it. When we first presented this problem to the brain, as I hope some of you remember, I went to great lengths to impress upon it the importance of rejecting any item of information capable of creating a dilemma. In doing so, I said something like, 'Don't get excited about the death of humans. We don't mind it at all. Just give the sheet back and forget it.'"
"Hmm," said Lanning. "What follows?"
"The obvious. When that item entered its calculations, which yielded the equation controlling the length of minimum interval for the interstellar jump, it meant death for humans. That's where Consolidated's machine broke down completely. But I had depressed the importance of death to the brain, not entirely, for the first law can never be broken, but just sufficiently so that the brain could take a second look at the equation. Sufficiently to give it time to realize that after the interval was passed through, the men would return to life. Just as the matter and energy of the ship itself would return to being.
This so-called death, in other words, was a strictly temporary phenomenon. You see? She looked about her. They were all listening. She went on. So he accepted the item, but not without a certain jar. Even with death temporary and its importance depressed, it was enough to unbalance him very gently. She brought it out calmly. He developed a sense of humor. It's an escape, you see, a method of partial escape from reality. He became a practical joker. Powell and Donovan were on their feet. What? Cried Powell. Donovan was considerably more colorful about it. It's so, said Calvin. He took care of you and kept you safe, but you couldn't handle any controls because they weren't for you, just for the humorous brain. We could reach you by radio, but you couldn't answer. You had plenty of food, but all of it beans and milk. Then you died, so to speak, and were reborn, but the period of your death was made, well, interesting. I wish I knew how he did it. It was the brain's prize joke, but he meant no harm. No harm, gasped Donovan. Oh, if that cute little tyke only had a neck! Lanning raised a quieting hand. All right, it's been a mess, but it's all over. What now? Well, said Bogart quietly, obviously it's up to us to improve the space warp engine. There must be some way of getting around that interval of jump. If there is, we're the only organization left with a grand-scale super robot, so we're bound to find it if anyone can. And then, U.S. Robots has interstellar travel, and humanity has the opportunity for galactic empire. What about Consolidated? Said Lanning. Hey, interrupted Donovan suddenly. I want to make a suggestion there. They landed U.S. Robots into quite a mess. It wasn't as bad a mess as they expected, and it turned out well, but their intentions weren't pious, and Greg and I bore the most of it. Well, they wanted an answer, and they've got one. Send them that ship, guaranteed, and U.S. Robots can collect their 200 thou plus construction costs. And if they test it, then suppose we let the brain have just a little more fun before it's brought back to normal. Lanning said gravely, It sounds just and proper to me. To which Bogart added absently, Strictly according to contract, too. Evidence. But that wasn't it either, said Dr. Calvin thoughtfully. Oh, eventually the ship and others like it became government property. The jump through hyperspace was perfected, and now we actually have human colonies on the planets of some of the nearer stars. But that wasn't it. I had finished eating and watched her through the smoke of my cigarette. It's what has happened to the people here on Earth in the last 50 years that really counts. When I was born, young man, we had just gone through the last World War. It was a low point in history, but it was the end of nationalism. Earth was too small for nations, and they began grouping themselves into regions. It took quite a while. When I was born, the United States of America was still a nation, and not merely a part of the northern region. In fact, the name of the corporation is still United States Robots. And the change from nations to regions, which has stabilized our economy and brought about what amounts to a golden age when this century is compared with the last, was also brought about by our robots. You mean the machines, I said. The brain you talked about was the first of the machines, wasn't it? Yes, it was. But it's not the machines I was thinking of. Rather, of a man. He died last year. Her voice was suddenly deeply sorrowful. Or at least he arranged to die because he knew we needed him no longer. Stephen Byerly. Yes, I guess that was who you meant. He first entered public office in 2032. You were only a boy then, so you wouldn't remember the strangeness of it. His campaign for the mayoralty was certainly the queerest in history. Francis Quinn was a politician of the new school. That, of course, is a meaningless expression, as are all expressions of the sort. Most of the new schools we have were duplicated in the social life of ancient Greece, and perhaps, if we knew more about it, in the social life of ancient Sumeria and in the lake dwellings of prehistoric Switzerland as well. But to get out from under what promises to be a dull and complicated beginning, it might be best to state hastily that Quinn neither ran for office nor canvassed for votes, made no speeches, and stuffed no ballot boxes, any more than Napoleon pulled the trigger at Austerlitz. And since politics makes strange bedfellows, Alfred Lanning sat at the other side of the desk with his ferocious white eyebrows bent far forward over eyes in which chronic impatience had sharpened to acuity. He was not pleased. The fact, if known to Quinn, would have annoyed him not the least. His voice was friendly, perhaps professionally so. "I assume you know Stephen Byerly, Dr. Lanning."
"I have heard of him. So have many people."
"Yes, so have I. Perhaps you intend voting for him at the next election."
I couldn't say.
There was an unmistakable trace of acidity here. I have not followed the political currents, so I'm not aware that he is running for office. He may be our next mayor. Of course, he is only a lawyer now, but Great Oaks... "Yes," interrupted Lanning, "I have heard the phrase before, but I wonder if we can get to the business at hand."
"We are at the business at hand, Dr. Lanning."
Quinn's tone was very gentle. "It is to my interest to keep Mr. Byerly a district attorney at the very most, and it is to your interest to help me do so."
"To my interest? Come."
Lanning's eyebrows hunched low. "Well, say then to the interest of the U.S. Robot and Mechanical Men Corporation. I come to you as Director Emeritus of Research because I know that your connection to them is that of, shall we say, elder statesmen. You are listened to with respect, and yet your connection with them is no longer so tight but that you cannot possess considerable freedom of action, even if the action is somewhat unorthodox." Dr. Lanning was silent a moment, chewing the cud of his thoughts. He said more softly, "I don't follow you at all, Mr. Quinn." "I am not surprised, Dr. Lanning. But it's all rather simple. Do you mind?" Quinn lit a slender cigarette with a lighter of tasteful simplicity, and his big boned face settled into an expression of quiet amusement. "We have spoken of Mr. Byerly, a strange and colorful character. He was unknown 3 years ago. He is very well known now. He is a man of force and ability, and certainly the most capable and intelligent prosecutor I have ever known. Unfortunately, he is not a friend of mine."
"I understand," said Lanning, mechanically.
He stared at his fingernails. "I have had occasion," continued Quinn, evenly, "in the past year to investigate Mr. Byerly. Quite exhaustively. It is always useful, you see, to subject the past life of reform politicians to rather inquisitive research. If you knew how often it helped." He paused to smile humorlessly at the glowing tip of his cigarette. "But Mr. Byerly's past is unremarkable. A quiet life in a small town, a college education, a wife who died young, an auto accident with a slow recovery, law school, coming to the metropolis, an attorney." Francis Quinn shook his head slowly, then added, "But his present life."
"Ah, that is remarkable.
Our district attorney never eats." Lanning's head snapped up, old eyes surprisingly sharp.
"Pardon me?"
"Our district attorney never eats." The repetition thumped by syllables. I'll modify that slightly. He has never been seen to eat or drink. Never. Do you understand the significance of the word? Not rarely, but never. I find that quite incredible. Can you trust your investigators? I can trust my investigators, and I don't find it incredible at all. Further, our district attorney has never been seen to drink, in the aqueous sense as well as the alcoholic, nor to sleep. There are other factors, but I should think I have made my point. Lanning leaned back in his seat, and there was the rapt silence of challenge and response between them, and then the old roboticist shook his head. No. There is only one thing you can be trying to imply if I couple your statements with the fact that you present them to me, and that is impossible. But the man is quite inhuman, Dr. Lanning. If you told me he were Satan in masquerade, there would be a faint chance that I might believe you. I tell you, he is a robot, Dr. Lanning. I tell you, it is as impossible a conception as I have ever heard, Mr. Quinn. Again, the combative silence. Nevertheless, and Quinn stubbed out his cigarette with elaborate care, you will have to investigate this impossibility with all the resources of the corporation. I'm sure that I could undertake no such thing, Mr. Quinn. You don't seriously suggest that the corporation take part in local politics. You have no choice. Supposing I were to make my facts public without proof. The evidence is circumstantial enough. Suit yourself in that respect. But it would not suit me. Proof would be much preferable. And it would not suit you, for the publicity would be very damaging to your company. You are perfectly well acquainted, I suppose, with the strict rules against the use of robots on inhabited worlds. Certainly. Brusquely. You know that the U.S. Robot and Mechanical Men Corporation is the only manufacturer of positronic robots in the solar system, and if Byerly is a robot, he is a positronic robot. You are also aware that all positronic robots are leased and not sold, that the corporation remains the owner and manager of each robot, and is therefore responsible for the actions of all. It is an easy matter, Mr. Quinn, to prove the corporation has never manufactured a robot of a humanoid character. It can be done, to discuss merely possibilities. Yes, it can be done. Secretly, I imagine, as well, without entering it in your books. Not the positronic brain, sir. Too many factors are involved in that, and there is the tightest possible government supervision. Yes, but robots are worn out, break down, go out of order, and are dismantled. And the positronic brains reused or destroyed. Really? Francis Quinn allowed himself a trace of sarcasm. And if one were accidentally, of course, not destroyed, and there happened to be a humanoid structure waiting for a brain. Impossible. You would have to prove that to the government and the public, so why not prove it to me now? But what could our purpose be? Demanded Lanning in exasperation. Where is our motivation? Credit us with a minimum of sense. My dear sir, please. The corporation would be only too glad to have the various regions permit the use of humanoid positronic robots on inhabited worlds. The profits would be enormous. But the prejudice of the public against such a practice is too great. Suppose you get them used to such robots first. See? We have a skillful lawyer, a good mayor, and he is a robot. Won't you buy our robot butlers? Thoroughly fantastic. An almost humorous descent to the ridiculous. I imagine so. Why not prove it? Or would you still rather try to prove it to the public?
The light in the office was dimming, but it was not yet too dim to obscure the flush of frustration on Alfred Lanning's face. Slowly, the roboticist's finger touched a knob, and the wall illuminators glowed to gentle life.
"Well, then," he growled, "let us see."
The face of Stephen Byerly is not an easy one to describe. He was 40 by birth certificate and 40 by appearance, but it was a healthy, well-nourished, good-natured appearance of 40, one that automatically drew the teeth of the bromide about looking one's age. This was particularly true when he laughed, and he was laughing now. It came loudly and continuously, died away for a bit, then began again. And Alfred Lanning's face contracted into a rigidly bitter monument of disapproval. He made a half-gesture to the woman who sat beside him, but her thin, bloodless lips merely pursed themselves a trifle. Byerly gasped himself a stage nearer normality.
"Really, Dr. Lanning, really? I? A robot?"
Lanning bit his words off with a snap. "It is no statement of mine, sir. I would be quite satisfied to have you a member of humanity. Since our corporation never manufactured you, I am quite certain that you are, in a legalistic sense at any rate. But since the contention that you are a robot has been advanced to us seriously by a man of certain standing, don't mention his name if it would knock a chip off your granite block of ethics, but let's pretend it was Frank Quinn, for the sake of argument, and continue." Lanning drew in a sharp, cutting snort at the interruption, and paused ferociously before continuing with added frigidity, "By a man of certain standing, with whose identity I am not interested in playing guessing games, I am bound to ask your cooperation in disproving it. The mere fact that such a contention could be advanced and publicized by the means at this man's disposal would be a bad blow to the company I represent, even if the charge were never proven. You understand me?"
"Oh, yes, your position is clear to me. The charge itself is ridiculous. The spot you find yourself in is not. I beg your pardon if my laughter offended you. It was the first I laughed at, not the second. How can I help you?"
"It could be very simple. You have only to sit down to a meal at a restaurant in the presence of witnesses, have your picture taken, and eat." Lanning sat back in his chair, the worst of the interview over. The woman beside him watched Byerly with an apparently absorbed expression, but contributed nothing of her own. Stephen Byerly met her eyes for an instant, was caught by them, then turned back to the roboticist. For a while his fingers were thoughtful over the bronze paperweight that was the only ornament on his desk. He said quietly, "I don't think I can oblige you." He raised his hand. "Now wait, Dr. Lanning. I appreciate the fact that this whole matter is distasteful to you, that you have been forced into it against your will, that you feel you are playing an undignified and even ridiculous part. Still, the matter is even more intimately concerned with myself, so be tolerant. First, what makes you think that Quinn, this man of certain standing, you know, wasn't hoodwinking you in order to get you to do exactly what you were doing? Why, it seems scarcely likely that a reputable person would endanger himself in so ridiculous a fashion if he weren't convinced he were on safe ground." There was little humor in Byerly's eyes. "You don't know Quinn. He could manage to make safe ground out of a ledge a mountain sheep could not handle. I suppose he showed the particulars of the investigation he claims to have made of me. Enough to convince me that it would be too troublesome to have our corporation attempt to disprove them when you could do so more easily."
"Then you believe him when he says I never eat?"
"You were a scientist, Dr. Lanning. Think of the logic required. I have not been observed to eat, therefore I never eat. QED. After all, you are using prosecution tactics to confuse what is really a very simple situation. On the contrary, I am trying to clarify what you and Quinn between you are making a very complicated one.
You see, I don't sleep much, that's true. And I certainly don't sleep in public. I have never cared to eat with others. An idiosyncrasy which is unusual and probably neurotic in character, but which harms no one. Look, Dr. Lanning, let me present you with a supposititious case. Supposing we had a politician who was interested in defeating a reform candidate at any cost, and while investigating his private life came across oddities such as I have just mentioned. Suppose further that in order to smear the candidate effectively, he comes to your company as the ideal agent. Do you expect him to say to you, so-and-so is a robot because he hardly ever eats with people, and I have never seen him fall asleep in the middle of a case, and once when I peeped into his window in the middle of the night, there he was, sitting up with a book, and I looked in his frigidaire, and there was no food in it? If he told you that, you would send for a straitjacket. But if he tells you he never sleeps, he never eats, then the shock of the statement blinds you to the fact that such statements are impossible to prove. You play into his hands by contributing to the to-do. Regardless, sir, began Lanning with a threatening obstinacy, of whether you consider this matter serious or not, it will require only the meal I mentioned to end it. Again Byerly turned to the woman, who still regarded him expressionlessly. Pardon me. I've caught your name correctly, haven't I? Dr. Susan Calvin. Yes, Mr. Byerly. You're the U.S. robot's psychologist, aren't you? Robo-psychologist, please. Oh. Are robots so different from men, mentally? Worlds different. She allowed herself a frosty smile. Robots are essentially decent. Humor tugged at the corners of the lawyer's mouth. Well, that's a hard blow. But what I wanted to say was this. Since you're a robo-psychologist and a woman, I'll bet that you've done something that Dr. Lanning hasn't thought of. And what is that? You've got something to eat in your purse. Something caught in the schooled indifference of Susan Calvin's eyes. She said, "You surprise me, Mr. Byerly." And opening her purse, she produced an apple. Quietly, she handed it to him. Dr. Lanning, after an initial start, followed the slow movement from one hand to the other with sharply alert eyes. Calmly, Stephen Byerly bit into it, and calmly, he swallowed it. You see, Dr. Lanning? Dr. Lanning smiled in a relief tangible enough to make even his eyebrows appear benevolent. A relief that survived for one fragile second. Susan Calvin said, I was curious to see if you would eat it, but of course, in the present case, it proves nothing. Byerly grinned. It doesn't. Of course not. It is obvious, Dr. Lanning, that if this man were a humanoid robot, he would be a perfect imitation. He is almost too human to be credible. After all, we have been seeing and observing human beings all our lives. It would be impossible to palm something merely nearly right off on us. It would have to be all right. Observe the texture of the skin, the quality of the irises, the bone formation of the hand. If he's a robot, I wish U.S. robots had made him, because he's a good job. Do you suppose, then, that anyone capable of paying attention to such niceties would neglect a few gadgets to take care of such things as eating, sleeping, elimination? For emergency use only, perhaps. As, for instance, to prevent such situations as are arising here. So a meal won't really prove anything. Now, wait, snarled Lanning. I am not quite the fool both of you make me out to be. I am not interested in the problem of Mr. Byerly's humanity or non-humanity. I am interested in getting the corporation out of a hole. A public meal will end the matter and keep it ended no matter what Quinn does. We can leave the finer details to lawyers and robo-psychologists. But, Dr. Lanning, said Byerly, you forget the politics of the situation. I am as anxious to be elected as Quinn is to stop me. By the way, did you notice that you used his name? It's a cheap, shyster trick of mine. I knew you would before you were through. Lanning flushed. What has the election to do with it?
Publicity works both ways, sir.
If Quinn wants to call me a robot and has the nerve to do so, I have the nerve to play the game his way.
You mean you?
Lanning was quite frankly appalled. Exactly. I mean that I'm going to let him go ahead, choose his rope, test its strength, cut off the right length, tie the noose, insert his head, and grin. I can do what little else is required.
You are mighty confident.
Susan Calvin rose to her feet. Come, Alfred, we won't change his mind for him. You see, Byerly smiled gently. You're a human psychologist, too. But perhaps not all the confidence that Dr. Lanning had remarked upon was present that evening when Byerly's car parked on the automatic treads leading to the sunken garage, and Byerly himself crossed the path to the front door of his house. The figure in the wheelchair looked up as he entered and smiled. Byerly's face lit with affection. He crossed over to it. The cripple's voice was a hoarse, grating whisper that came out of a mouth forever twisted to one side, leering out of a face that was half scar tissue.
You're late, Steve.
I know, John. I know. But I've been up against a peculiar and interesting trouble today.
So?
Neither the torn face nor the destroyed voice could carry expression, but there was anxiety in the clear eyes.
Nothing you can't handle.
I'm not exactly certain. I may need your help. You're the brilliant one in the family. Do you want me to take you out into the garden? It's a beautiful evening. Two strong arms lifted John from the wheelchair. Gently, almost caressingly, Byerly's arms went around the shoulders and under the swathed legs of the cripple. Carefully and slowly, he walked through the rooms, down the gentle ramp that had been built with a wheelchair in mind, and out the back door into the walled and wired garden behind the house.
Why don't you let me use the wheelchair, Steve? This is silly.
Because I'd rather carry you. Do you object? You know that you're as glad to get out of that motorized buggy for a while as I am to see you out. How do you feel today? He deposited John with infinite care upon the cool grass.
How should I feel?
But tell me about your troubles. Quinn's campaign will be based on the fact that he claims I'm a robot. John's eyes opened wide.
How do you know? It's impossible. I won't believe it.
Oh, come. I tell you, it's so. He had one of the big-shot scientists of U.S. Robot and Mechanical Men Corporation over at the office to argue with me. Slowly, John's hands tore at the grass.
I see. I see.
Byerly said, but we can let him choose his ground. I have an idea. Listen to me and tell me if we can do it. The scene as it appeared in Alfred Lanning's office that night was a tableau of stares. Francis Quinn stared meditatively at Alfred Lanning. Lanning's stare was savagely set upon Susan Calvin, who stared impassively in her turn at Quinn. Francis Quinn broke it with a heavy attempt at lightness. Bluff! He's making it up as he goes along.
Are you going to gamble on that, Mr. Quinn? Asked Dr. Calvin indifferently.
Well, it's your gamble, really. Look here. Lanning covered definite pessimism with bluster. We've done what you asked. We witnessed the man eat. It's ridiculous to presume him a robot.
Do you think so?
Quinn shot toward Calvin. Lanning said you were the expert. Lanning was almost threatening.
Now, Susan.
Quinn interrupted smoothly. Why not let her talk, man? She's been sitting there imitating a gatepost for half an hour. Lanning felt definitely harassed. From what he experienced then to incipient paranoia was but a step. He said, very well. Have your say, Susan. We won't interrupt you. Susan Calvin glanced at him humorlessly, then fixed cold eyes on Mr. Quinn. There are only two ways of definitely proving Byerly to be a robot, sir. So far, you were presenting circumstantial evidence with which you can accuse but not prove. And I think Mr. Byerly is sufficiently clever to counter that sort of material. You probably think so yourself, or you wouldn't have come here. The two methods of proof are the physical and the psychological. Physically, you can dissect him or use an X-ray. How to do that would be your problem. Psychologically, his behavior can be studied, for if he is a positronic robot, he must conform to the three rules of robotics. A positronic brain cannot be constructed without them. You know the rules, Mr. Quinn. She spoke them carefully, clearly, quoting word for word the famous bold print on page one of the Handbook of Robotics. "I've heard of them," said Quinn, carelessly. "Then the matter is easy to follow," responded the psychologist, dryly. "If Mr. Byerly breaks any of those three rules, he is not a robot. Unfortunately, this procedure works in only one direction. If he lives up to the rules, it proves nothing one way or the other." Quinn raised polite eyebrows. "Why not, doctor?" "Because, if you stop to think of it, the three rules of robotics are the essential guiding principles of a good many of the world's ethical systems. Of course, every human being is supposed to have the instinct of self-preservation. That's rule three to a robot. Also, every good human being, with a social conscience and a sense of responsibility, is supposed to defer to proper authority. To listen to his doctor, his boss, his government, his psychiatrist, his fellow man. To obey laws, to follow rules, to conform to custom, even when they interfere with his comfort or his safety. That's rule two to a robot. Also, every good human being is supposed to love others as himself, protect his fellow man, risk his life to save another. That's rule one to a robot. To put it simply, if Byerly follows all the rules of robotics, he may be a robot and may simply be a very good man." "But," said Quinn, "you're telling me that you can never prove him a robot." "I may be able to prove him not a robot." "That's not the proof I want." "You'll have such proof as exists. You were the only one responsible for your own wants." Here Lanning's mind leaped suddenly to the sting of an idea. "Has it occurred to anyone," he ground out, "that district attorney is a rather strange occupation for a robot? The prosecution of human beings, sentencing them to death, bringing about their infinite harm?" Quinn grew suddenly keen. "No, you can't get out of it that way. Being district attorney doesn't make him human. Don't you know his record? Don't you know that he boasts that he has never prosecuted an innocent man? That there are scores of people left untried because the evidence against them didn't satisfy him, even though he could probably have argued a jury into atomizing them? That happens to be so." Lanning's thin cheeks quivered. "No, Quinn, no. There is nothing in the rules of robotics that makes any allowance for human guilt. A robot may not judge whether a human being deserves death. It is not for him to decide. He may not harm a human. Variety skunk or variety angel." Susan Calvin sounded tired. "Alfred," she said, "don't talk foolishly. What if a robot came upon a madman about to set fire to a house with people in it? He would stop the madman, wouldn't he?" "Of course." "And if the only way he could stop him was to kill him?" There was a faint sound in Lanning's throat. Nothing more. "The answer to that, Alfred, is that he would do his best not to kill him. If the madman died, the robot would require psychotherapy, because he might easily go mad at the conflict presented him, of having broken Rule 1 to adhere to Rule 1 in a higher sense. But a man would be dead, and a robot would have killed him." "Well, is Byerly mad?" demanded Lanning, with all the sarcasm he could muster.
No, but he has killed no man himself. He has exposed facts which might represent a particular human being to be dangerous to the large mass of other human beings we call society. He protects the greater number and thus adheres to Rule 1 at maximum potential. That is as far as he goes. It is the judge who then condemns the criminal to death or imprisonment after the jury decides on his guilt or innocence. It is the jailer who imprisons him, the executioner who kills him. And Mr. Byerly has done nothing but determine truth and aid society. As a matter of fact, Mr. Quinn, I have looked into Mr. Byerly's career since you first brought this matter to our attention. I find that he has never demanded the death sentence in his closing speeches to the jury. I also find that he has spoken on behalf of the abolition of capital punishment and contributed generously to research institutions engaged in criminal neurophysiology. He apparently believes in the cure rather than the punishment of crime. I find that significant. You do? Quinn smiled. Significant of a certain odor of roboticity, perhaps? Perhaps. Why deny it? Actions such as his could come only from a robot, or from a very honorable and decent human being. But you see, you just can't differentiate between a robot and the very best of humans. Quinn sat back in his chair. His voice quivered with impatience. Dr. Lanning, it's perfectly possible to create a humanoid robot that would perfectly duplicate a human in appearance, isn't it? Lanning harumphed and considered. It's been done experimentally by U.S. robots, he said reluctantly, without the addition of a positronic brain, of course. By using human ova and hormone control, one can grow human flesh and skin over a skeleton of porous silicone plastics that would defy external examination. The eyes, the hair, the skin would be really human, not humanoid. And if you put a positronic brain and such other gadgets as you might desire inside, you have a humanoid robot. Quinn said shortly, how long would it take to make one? Lanning considered, if you had all your equipment, the brain, the skeleton, the ovum, the proper hormones and radiations, say 2 months. The politician straightened out of his chair. Then we shall see what the insides of Mr. Byerly look like. It will mean publicity for you as robots, but I gave you your chance. Lanning turned impatiently to Susan Calvin when they were alone. Why do you insist? And with real feeling she responded sharply and instantly. Which do you want? The truth or my resignation? I won't lie for you. U.S. robots can take care of itself. Don't turn coward. What, said Lanning, if he opens up Byerly and wheels and gears fall out? What then? He won't open Byerly, said Calvin disdainfully. Byerly is as clever as Quinn at the very least. The news broke upon the city a week before Byerly was to have been nominated. But broke is the wrong word. It staggered upon the city, shambled, crawled. Laughter began, and wit was free. And as the far-off hand of Quinn tightened its pressure in easy stages, the laughter grew forced. An element of hollow uncertainty entered, and people broke off to wonder. The convention itself had the air of a restive stallion. There had been no contest planned. Only Byerly could possibly have been nominated a week earlier. There was no substitute even now. They had to nominate him, but there was complete confusion about it. It would not have been so bad if the average individual were not torn between the enormity of the charge, if true, and its sensational folly, if false. The day after Byerly was nominated perfunctorily, hollowly, a newspaper finally published the gist of a long interview with Dr. Susan Calvin, world-famous expert on robopsychology and positronics. What broke loose is popularly and succinctly described as hell. It was what the fundamentalists were waiting for. They were not a political party, They made pretense to no formal religion. Essentially, they were those who had not adapted themselves to what had once been called the atomic age, in the days when atoms were a novelty. Actually, they were the simple lifers, hungering after a life which to those who lived it had probably appeared not so simple, and who had been therefore simple lifers themselves. The fundamentalists required no new reason to detest robots and robot manufacturers, but a new reason such as the Quinn accusation and the Calvin analysis was sufficient to make such detestation audible. The huge plants of the U.S. Robot and Mechanical Men Corporation was a hive that spawned armed guards. It prepared for war. Within the city, the house of Stephen Byerly bristled with police. The political campaign, of course, lost all other issues, and resembled a campaign only in that it was something filling the hiatus between nomination and election. Stephen Byerly did not allow the fussy little man to distract him. He remained comfortably unperturbed by the uniforms in the background. Outside the house, past the line of grim guards, reporters and photographers waited according to the tradition of the caste. One enterprising visor station even had a scanner focused on the blank entrance to the prosecutor's unpretentious home, while a synthetically excited announcer filled in with inflated commentary. The fussy little man advanced. He held forward a rich, complicated sheet. "This, Mr. Byerly, is a court order authorizing me to search these premises for the presence of illegal, mechanical men or robots of any description." Byerly half rose and took the paper. He glanced at it indifferently and smiled as he handed it back. "All in order? Go ahead, do your job." "Mrs. Oppen," to his housekeeper, who appeared reluctantly from the next room, "please go with them and help out if you can." The little man, whose name was Haraway, hesitated, produced an unmistakable blush, failed completely to catch Byerly's eyes, and muttered, "Come on," to the two policemen. He was back in 10 minutes. "Through?" questioned Byerly, in just the tone of a person who is not particularly interested in the question or its answer. Haraway cleared his throat, made a bad start in falsetto, and began again, angrily. "Look here, Mr. Byerly. Our special instructions were to search the house very thoroughly."
"And haven't you?"
"We were told exactly what to look for."
"Yes?"
"In short, Mr. Byerly, and not to put too fine a point on it, we were told to search you."
"Me," said the prosecutor with a broadening smile. "And how do you intend to do that?"
"We have a Pennant radiation unit."
"Then I'm to have my X-ray photograph taken, eh?"
"You have the authority?"
"You saw my warrant."
"May I see it again?" Haraway, his forehead shining with considerably more than mere enthusiasm, passed it over a second time. Byerly said evenly, "I read here as the description of what you are to search. I quote, 'The dwelling place belonging to Stephen Allen Byerly, located at 355 Willow Grove, Evanston, together with any garage, storehouse, or other structures or buildings thereto appertaining, together with all grounds thereto appertaining,' and so on." "Quite an order. But, my good man, it doesn't say anything about searching my interior. I am not part of the premises. You may search my clothes if you think I've got a robot hidden in my pocket." Haraway had no doubt on the point of to whom he owed his job. He did not propose to be backward, given a chance to earn a much better, that is, more highly paid job. He said, in a faint echo of bluster, "Look here. I'm allowed to search the furniture in your house and anything else I find in it. You are in it, aren't you?"
"A remarkable observation. I am in it.
But I'm not a piece of furniture. As a citizen of adult responsibility, I have the psychiatric certificate proving that, I have certain rights under the regional articles. Searching me would come under the heading of violating my right of privacy. That paper isn't sufficient."
"Sure.
But if you're a robot, you don't have right of privacy."
True enough, but that paper still isn't sufficient. It recognizes me implicitly as